friends, and welcome to the Experience Grind podcast, the show about getting older and the experiences we've gained along the way through movies, TV, games, music, all that pop culture goodness. I'm your host this week, Brian, and I'm joined by our usual crew of co-hosts, like Ryan.
Hi. Oh, shit, I forgot to have an intro ready, so hello!
We also have Kyle.
Generally, I prefer white bread over wheat bread.
That's just a look into the psyche there. Sean?
If I were to watch the show Pete and Pete, if I'm going to be honest, I prefer Pete over Pete.
Same. And finally, Dave.
I tried explaining what a VHS tape was to my kids at one point. Completely useless. Completely useless. I tried to describe it as like a pre-DVD. Just as useless.
What's a DVD?
So like you had to click on what on the internet to get to it?
Pretty much.
This week we're going to be talking about the 2024 American psychological horror drama written and directed by Jane Schoenbrunn. I saw the TV glow. I picked this movie because, like, damn it, I wanted to watch it. It's something that has been on my radar since it came out, and I saw a preview, and I went, that looks neat. I would like to watch that. I never got around to it.
Is this one of those movies that you wouldn't have watched without knowing you were going to talk about it for a show? Were you holding it to talk about here?
No, it was less that I was holding it, and more that I saw the opportunity to watch a movie I wanted to watch because I had to choose a movie for the show.
That's so fair.
Actually the exact opposite.
That's how I watch a lot of the movies that I watch is like, has anybody talked about this prior? No, good. I'll just save it for my next pick of whatever we're going to talk about because I want to watch this movie.
Yeah. Sometimes that'll bite you in the ass because it'll end up being like a not so great movie. And you're like, well, wish I'd watched that on my own instead of wasting everybody's time.
Had you seen We're All Going to the World's Fair?
No.
Yes.
I actually didn't even know it existed until I started looking into stuff after I watched this. So,
what did you think of that, Ryan?
I'm assuming you brought it up because you've also seen it. Yeah.
I have not seen it. I just know that it's one of Jane's prior films.
I think it's their first film, and I think this is their second, but it's got really good ideas. It is, I think, a lot less technically impressive of a film. It is shot not nearly as nicely. It's on a real cheap digital camera versus like the 35mm that I saw the TV glows on. And it's a very small movie, too, comparatively. It almost takes place in one location, a la Paranormal Activity. So it's very different. Touching on very similar themes when it comes to how media affects us and can like warp or have like such an influence on our lives. But if you see I Saw the TV Glow, I think you should just go with that one first. I think it is the better movie by a long shot. But I do think after you see it, go back, and I think you'll find stuff to appreciate with We're All Going to the World's Fair. But I would not flip-flop that order.
Now, had any of you guys seen I Saw the TV Glow before this?
Yes.
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 Nope. Am I the only one that's a nope?
Time too, obviously.
No, Brian. Yeah. So
just me and Dave going in blind. So what did you guys think of it after seeing it the first time?
I personally thought I was, man, I liked it, but I felt like I was sold a bill of goods based off of the marketing and description of it. I went into it wanting a different kind of movie and expecting a different kind of movie, but at the end of it, I still enjoyed it, but it was not what I expected going into it. And so I'm not saying that that diminished how I felt about it, but it's something that will always kind of be hand in hand with this movie for me. Dave.
When you say that the marketing and the way it was kind of put out there kind of threw you off, how was it marketed? Because I actually don't know this.
As a horror movie.
Okay. I saw the word horror movie put in there kind of in the title. I mean, we've seen that me and Brian with musicals, and then they're not musicals at all. Right, Brian? Right? Right? Right?
Are we talking about Earth Girls for Easy again?
Again. I can't believe I got it in here. But I have no clue how this was marketed. I know with A24 movies, that's kind of one of their fortes is how they market things, though. So I'm kind of curious what everyone else's take on it is, if they market it as a horror movie.
Okay.
And what their takeaway from there was.
Perhaps it's less of the marketing because I don't watch trailers. It was in like the horror section, but and more so possibly, I guess, perhaps my own doing of looking up like best horror movies of this year that have come out. So looking at lists of horror, and every one of them had this movie on it. And so not so much on the marketing side of things, I guess, but in terms of how it was presented to me and how I found out about it, it wasn't what I expected.
Yeah. I heard a lot of that about this movie.
I can see the bait and switch kind of being a thing, but I still do think this is a horror movie, especially for the target audience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd just say on the whole, I think it's a little bit maybe also sort of like a Black Panther situation where it's not a movie really made for me, but I'm still trying to understand it and see where it's coming from and relate in the ways that I can.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting comparison.
Well, that's the way I classified it back forever ago. I mean,
so you're going to say, I just compare everything to Black Panther and then just see where it goes.
But I mean, I think the one a lot of people are familiar with. I know there's other examples, but at least to me, you know, just understanding like where it's coming from, you know, what it's trying to reach, who it's trying to really affect, and know that it's not me, but I can still try to appreciate and understand. So,
It's interesting because I don't think this movie got as much of the backlash from a certain community that other movies like this have gotten, like say a Black Panther or like a Crazy Rich Asians. There's always that one group of people
love Crazy Rich Asians
that have an issue just because of not being represented within it. Yeah. And I didn't hear a lot of that with this movie. Maybe it's just because it's such a smaller scale.
We'll get to it when we start ranking this, but like the box office will show you this did not reach the same level masses that both of those who were like blockbusters when it came to audience turnouts did. And also, so when a four quadrant movie explodes, it reaches the chuds, and the chuds have a loud voice. This hasn't reached the chuds yet. That's it.
Exactly. And if you think about
that, makes sense.
The chuds and the folks that are going to just, I don't lambast this for no reason at all. It's usually because it's right in the name, you know, they can find any small thing like that to latch onto. Instead, this one's kind of obscured behind a title.
So there were two questions asked. One was about the trailer, how it was marketed. And I just wanted to touch on that real quick and just say, like, I think for me, too, like at this point, it was an A24 production. And I think A24 is kind of synonymous with selling like something much more viscerally scary than they actually are, because they're more cerebrally scary. And I think by this point, like, I've just come to know, like, if it's A24, don't expect, like, blood and big, like, shocking things like that. You're expecting, like, character horror and, like, really, like,
right,
you know, it's traumatic.
Psychological. It's more
like
psychological.
Midsommar. Yeah. Take what do they call it? They call it Midsommar? Horrifying, still.
Mm-hmm. It's like elevated horror or enhanced horror or whatever term they use to puff themselves up.
That's it. Yeah. Uh-huh. 100%. Second part was, how did I feel about this? And speaking to Kyle's Black Panther, even though this shouldn't be my Black Panther, this is my Black Panther and spoke to me on so many fucking levels. I think even if you're not in this community, you can still feel like the stings of just like loneliness or having to feel like you don't quite belong or something's not like quite, you know, right with you, or there should be something better. It speaks on like, geez, just media's influence with us and like how it can like be this powerful form of escapism, but also maybe shape us in a way for the better or worse. Who knows? But like, it does shape and affect us. And it has so much to say, and there are so many ends that even if you aren't in that community specifically, I was still moved on such a fucking level, and it only deepened the second time around. So that's where I'm saying.
All right. On that note, maybe we just get right into this and give it a score. We're going to go through our usual categories of the from the Beer Me scoring system that we have brought over last week, and we're going to see how we can do it a second time here before going back to, you know, whatever the experienced boys are feeling in the next one. But I like the way last week went, and damn it, I'm sticking with it.
You like it?
So we're going to go through 10 categories: casting, story and motivation, protagonist, antagonist, director, style and tone, screenplay, music, box office, and impact on the industry. In that order, each one is worth 10 points. We're all going to score it. We'll get the average, and then we'll get a total at the end out of 100 points. So our first category is casting.
You got Justice Smith. You got Bridget Lundy Payne, Helena Howard, Lindsay Jordan, Danielle Deadwyler, Fred Durst, Connor O'Malley, a whole bunch of other people.
A lot of Emma Portner. She plays like four roles in this movie.
That's true. And you also got Mike Marone and Danny Tamborelli at points.
Respect on the names.
What a like random out of left field. Like if listeners aren't listening or haven't seen this and don't get that, yeah, like the two brothers from Pete and Pete are in this movie.
It's not as out of left field as you think. It's not. It's not.
It's not, I guess, having seen it.
For a lot of reasons.
It's a weird thing to hear if you haven't seen it.
I texted Brian around 5 minutes after I started watching this movie. And Brian, what did I text you?
You texted me that, hey, this feels like it's in New Jersey.
And that's because it was shot in New Jersey. Right away, I got that. It was shot mostly in Verona, New Jersey, which is North Jersey. Legitimately around 10 minutes away from Tony Soprano's house in Caldwell. But
wow.
The Adventures of Pete and Pete shot around 20 minutes away from that in Wyckoff, New Jersey. So I feel like it kept that sort of tone alive, geographically at least. Like, I felt it the entire time. You have this entire scene that takes place on the Verona high school soccer football field. And when I looked at that, that changed to Void High School because, I mean, V, that's a tricky one to do.
Yeah.
But man, I've scored so many goals on that field. It felt so good seeing it on film. It felt so good.
That's so cool.
I never clocked that a town that starts with a V would have a VHS as their high school. Awesome. And then I suddenly got jealous.
I was too.
My town started with an M.
Can I spend this time to really just jump in with my visual aids? Because I feel they've been set up kind of perfectly. Because everybody in this show... if you know me for any amount of time, I have a definite soft spot for 90s television the degree that I have all that. So I have Pete and Pete season 1 and 2. This is Hey Dude, the complete series. Secret World of Alex Mack.
Fucking love Alex
man,
Mack.
After my heart.
I have Clarissa Explains It All season 1. So yeah, this movie speaks to me on a good level. I fucking loved every aspect of it. I think the casting nailed the awkwardness of the 90s team, but I mean that's kind of ubiquitous and eternal. So I just want to personally the only other thing I'd seen the main character Justice Smith in, or I'm sorry, Ian Foreman was Detective Pikachu.
Eric Foreman?
Oh, is he? Is he in Detective Pikachu?
Yeah.
He is. Yeah.
And so
Justice Smith is,
I mean, I liked him in Detective Pikachu, but I really liked him in this too. He's got range. So.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Casting, are we scoring right now too?
Yeah.
I'll give it 8.
All right.
Going high. Impressed. Also, they got my man Fred Durst in there. We rolling.
You got to give it a Fred Durst bump.
We rolling.
Have to. It's so offensive how, was it Jay-Z who said made the Yankee hat more famous than a Yankee can? And I'm sitting there going, motherfucker, Fred Durst.
Yeah.
He's the one who got it first. All right.
Every time I hear that line, I get viscerally upset because, like, there have been so many New York Yankees that wear that hat.
Okay. So I have a question here on this ranking system. All right. So,
I thought it was about the Yankees and Fred Durst. I got real excited. I'm less excited now.
I can talk about them business. If you want.
No, no.
No, just keep rolling, Sean.
What position do you think Fred Durst would play?
I know you'd be loving this shit right here.
Right here. Wow. So on these rankings, would you start at a baseline of 10 and subtract points from there because of casting issues that you had? Or would you start at a 5 and move it up or down from there?
Like,
I think by default you want to start at a 5 and then adjust accordingly.
5's
out. I kind of just go with the little man in my stomach tells me to do.
Yeah, that's how I've done.
Huh? I just go from the heart. The
little man
in
the
gut.
Stomach.
Little man in the stomach.
I've put any thought into anything in 400 episodes, and it's all from the gut.
Okay. Well, my gut was saying I don't have any issues with this cast. Actually, you know what? I'm gonna give this a 9. I can't fault anything on this. It so perfectly encapsulates what you're seeing. It's the 90s. It felt like how things felt for me as a kid in school, sitting on the floor, leaning against a wall in a gymnasium. Like, these are normal ass kids. These are normal ass parents. Nobody's glamorous. It felt like normal life. Yeah, not to say that normal life isn't glamorous, but it felt like real people going through very real things that they were going through. And I thought the casting accordingly was quite perfect for the movie. I don't know what could bring it to a 10. I don't know. But I don't think I can go lower than a 9.
I'm glad that they didn't cast big names in this, because there is an everyman quality to every single one of these characters. It could be anyone. And I appreciate that.
Yeah.
That said, I'm also going to go with like an 8, I think.
Okay.
And it still feels high. I don't know what I don't like about it. I don't know what would make it higher. I don't know what would make it lower. 8 feels right.
It's funny how this is one of those movies where it's like, you're going with the little man in your stomach. You don't know why. Like, can I dock it? No. Can I give it more? I don't know. Dave, how are you feeling?
I think.
How's your little man feeling?
I'm gonna say words that I don't normally say.
Uh-oh.
I didn't like this movie.
Oh.
I could have called this.
By I kind of could too.
Why?
I don't know. It just
No, that's not an answer, because you're saying that you could have called it. I'm kind of curious now. Why?
Speaking from the gut, remember?
Speaking from gut, I think it's very niche. It's very specific, and I don't think it's broad enough for you. I think the things that it's speaking at don't speak to you as a person, knowing you as a person. That's it. Of all of us here, I think, and I don't mean this in a bad way, I feel like you're like the most put together dude, whereas I feel like everybody else here, or you're the dudest dude, whereas everybody else here I look at, and I feel like we all have been very, like, music episode is a perfect example. We all have our, like, insecurities and vulnerabilities, and we're, like, sad boy stuff, right? You're not sad boy. Mm-hmm. And that's why I don't think this would speak to you. That was my gut instinct. I've not seen it yet from what I've heard either. Well, on podcasts, anyway. On podcasts. About movies and stuff.
Much like last week when we watched a film noir, and I said, when I watch these type of movies, I call these Dave movies. The first time I watched, I saw the TV glow, I said, this is a Ryan movie. Yep. About the time we got to the second consecutive girl power musical performance, I was like, this is a Ryan movie. And most people don't like Ryan movies, having watched a lot of movies with Ryan.
So, just in that regard,
I was like, I don't feel like Dave's going to be into this one. I didn't know how Brian would feel about it, but since he brought it to the table, I thought he'd be into it.
He's curious.
Not that you would hate it. I just didn't think it would be your vibe.
Oh, I thought
I'm not using the word
hate.
Yeah, I would never use the word hate unless we're talking about Spawn. But no, it's funny because it's like the way I watch movies is I always right after it's done, I ask myself, did I like that? And there's nothing behind that of like I've watched enough movies at this point that like you know in your gut like did I like that or did I not like that? And I watched this yesterday. And I try not to watch anything in between watching whatever we're going to talk about and then talking about it, just so I don't have anything kind of like muddying the waters up too much. I've been thinking about this all day and just trying to figure out like what didn't sit well with me. Hmm. Part of it's the casting. Because I thought that Justice Smith did a totally fine job. Ian Foreman did a totally fine job. Bridget Lundy Payne did a totally fine job. But it was the fact that it was only a totally fine job in my mind where it felt like they were very... very one-dimensional characters who wanted you, who were telling you to feel other things. And that's one thing that hasn't sat well with me with this movie. We'll get there for style and tone, but I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out. And that's why I like talking about this stuff because you guys obviously have different things that you want to talk about. And I'm really curious what other people have to say and kind of, I don't know, try to figure this movie out still. Because I've been trying to figure it out for a solid day. And the only thing I do know is that my gut after watching it said, I don't think I like that. But I'm still kind of working my way through. So for casting,
interesting.
Because I felt that they were kind of one-dimensional and were telling me how they were feeling, I'm going to go with a 6. Because I don't think that they were wrong for it. I felt like the way that they acted it and the way that they were directed to act it and then the way it was shot, it was more telling me how I should be feeling about something instead of me seeing it on them.
Interesting.
Okay, yeah.
Well, Ryan? The cheese stands alone yet again. At least I'll be in the positive side and defend something for once. I was going to bury the lead, but I don't think there's any reason to now. I think the casting, the word perfect has been dropped, but I still feel like we're being tepid. But like, I think... you don't need a blockbuster casting or big names to be perfect casting and get a great score. And I think that's what this does. I think this perfectly cast from within the community. We talk about all of the 90s sitcom actors. When they do the 90s stuff, it feels so fucking authentic to a young adult 90s show. Everything is perfect here. Then you get all the like extra cameos. You get Pete and Pete. You get Tara from Buffy. You get fucking all the music people. And I know you guys... are definitely not on the same wavelength of music as I am, but like I know a lot of these people. So like seeing Snail Mail pop up and Phoebe Bridgers pop up, like these are people I know. And like they're actually important people to the LGBTQ plus community. And so it all makes sense thematically. I don't know. I think this is perfect casting. And if we did it last week, fuck it. I'm giving it the bonus point too. This is an 11 out of 10. This is
nice.
What this, you could not cast this movie better.
Wow.
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 That is going to average out for an 8 for casting.
Okay.
And is going to bring us to our next category, which is the story and motivation. In 1996, teenagers Owen and Maddie form a bond over a television show, The Pink Opaque. I should say, before we even get into this, if you have not watched this movie, spoilers, major spoilers are coming. This is one of those movies that you kind of want to go into blind. So if you have interest in seeing this, stop now, watch the movie, come back, because we're about to get into it and completely, yeah. Themes,
but it's interesting
that
when you say that, because I brought up something. It was just like I put a friendly reminder that a couple people in this movie had they, them pronouns. And I say that a lot for me because I'm terrible with pronouns, mostly because I'm from Jersey. I just call everyone guys. Like, hey, guys. It doesn't matter who. Like, and that's on me.
Taylor Ham guy.
But then I got told that being a transgender allegory and everything like that, like, keep that in the back of your head. And I had watched the movie already at that point. And now I'm starting to like backtrack in my head of how to connect things of like, I mean, I got that, but am I supposed to get something else out? We're going to get there obviously, but
wow.
I just find that interesting about how going blind, but
that's funny.
I don't know.
Cause
yeah.
literally, to me, with the trans relation, this movie is not subtle at all.
It's not
completely over the head with
Trust me, I know.
Still missed it for quite a bit of it.
Like, yeah. the fucking parachute at the beginning is the trans flag, and I was I was like, oh, okay.
And there's windows the same way. Stained glass windows.
It's so that's wild to me that like there were things that still could be not immediately picked up, and I guess it's maybe just unfamiliarity with the subject. So.
Yeah,
I got a solid amount into this movie before I was like, oh, duh. And then I was like, oh, yeah, they're laying it on thick. But yeah, it's there are other themes at play here for sure. And the things to relate to outside of the trans community.
Nostalgia.
There's a lot to dabble in. Not dabble, but there's a lot to unpack in this movie.
But we will get there for sure. Back into the synopsis. The Pink Opaque is a late 19 supernatural drama that features Isabel and Tara, who discover they have a psychic link and must meet on the psychic plane to fight monsters sent by the man in the moon, Mr. Melancholy, who is, of course, trying to trap the girls in the Midnight Realm. Typical 90s teen fare.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. The show seems pretty cool.
It reminds me a lot of the Vampire Diaries, which I think is just a ridiculous nonsense thing. And I was making fun of it one day to find out that my very large male coworker next to me absolutely loved the show. And I was like, ah, I'm so sorry, buddy.
My bad.
Because it is just young adult schlock. But
yeah, the Pink Opaque just made me feel like I was every time they showed it. A marriage of like Buffy and Power Rangers.
Yes,
and
the secret world
Power Rangers
Alex
for
Mack.
Sure.
Oh, dude, Alex and Mack it just too, brought me back. So I was like a kid, just weird.
Brian mentioned
I was definitely.
Oh, I was just gonna say in his casting, like how those '90s segments felt so authentic, and I, dude, watching it both times, it's crazy because they're even like acting not great. Like it's that 90s TV acting style where it's just a hair overdramatic and
terrible fighting and
just absolutely completely nailed. The only thing I think the Pink Opaque is the dumbest name for a show I've ever heard.
I feel like that's on purpose.
I hope.
Also
it
making
is
fun
awful.
Of those shows.
I mean, how good of a name is Buffy the Vampire Slayer when you really think about it?
Abe Lincoln the Vampire Slayer, way better. And not because it's a guy. That's sexist and terrible. Somebody keep somebody start talking in.
Somebody talk quick. Somebody quick.
Cut Sean off.
Please.
Due to the show's late night airtime, Owen has to sneak out to Maddie's house to watch the show, deepening their friendship and their mutual obsession with the show. Over the next 2 years, Maddie leaves VHS recordings of the show for Owen to watch on his own. But they, other than that, they really don't talk much.
No, they don't. But also, this isn't a 10:30 show.
No.
9:30.
This isn't the type of stuff that's, I would say, like, this is big orange couch, 9 o'clock.
Exactly.
Are you afraid of the dark time? Like, that's where this fits in. 10:30, what are we doing here?
Yeah. 10:30, maybe they're in a different time zone. Maybe
they're not. I felt the time zone in my heart. Right,
it's
my
the tri-state area. We established that with Pete and Pete and Dave getting all the Jersey vibes.
It was like starting to sweat Taylor Ham watching this thing.
I never knew what the tri-state area was as a kid. I just
there are so many tri-state areas.
Yeah, like all over the place. Every county you go to has a tri-state area if it's in three states or something.
If you're up in the Northeast
except for the four
where the
corners.
States are that small, it's like
quad state.
The quad state area.
This is a fascinating relationship between Owen and Maddie. Like, the entire time. It is so fascinating that this is just like two kids going through their own traumas that have found a connection, like a human connection between each other. That don't have a lot to talk about, just get together and being in each other's company while enjoying something that they both like. And everything that kind of ensues from this point forward, I looking back, really enjoyed this relationship. And I did in the time too, but yeah, I don't know. Kyle?
I was just to expound on some things that were kind of brushed up earlier about, like, I don't know, and I might be looking too into this, but to me, it seems to me like Owen has autism as well. And the way that a lot of this movie is presented mm-hmm. is in an autistic viewpoint. And that's why yes. I feel it can be a little bit hard to maybe follow or enjoy, because it is kind of so flat and so confusing in mm-hmm. ways. And I think that's purposeful. So
I could see that. They do make a point a few different times to show he doesn't not make eye contact with anybody.
They went out of their way to say that even. Mm-hmm. To that, yeah. Like, oh, why don't you just make eye contact with me? Cut.
And they
so
can't.
It's like, okay, I think yeah. we're setting up this character in a
but I feel
interesting way.
I think that's also common. Like, that's why they, I know that autistic people have trouble with social cues and mm-hmm. communicating their own. And I think that's why they verbally kind of speak them, which is another thing, like, they are telling you how they feel rather than showing.
Yeah.
I like the way you just worded that, because that is one of my bigger issues with this movie, is that it does a lot of telling and not showing. Mm-hmm. And I do think that is by design, which I think works and not works. Like, the first 45 minutes of this movie, I was in, and I was in hard on mm-hmm. it. And then we'll get there. It's not important now. But in terms of the relationship that is here, we have Owen talking to Maddie because she's reading a book, an episode guide of The Pink Opaque. He's never watched it. He knows it. He's just kind of curious about it. And he asks her about it.
Yeah.
She kind of makes fun of him calling him baby because he's only in 7th grade and she's in 9th grade. And then she Relatable. Has a reaction and has to go talk to him. Why did she talk to him? What in her character made her go talk to him? And this is a genuine question. I'm not, like, doing gotcha bullshit here. I'm actually him. Trying
it
to understand the movie.
Genuine human empathy. And okay. It was a relationship yeah. formed out of empathy where he's not had that.
She saw herself in him in a certain way.
Yeah.
This just seemed fast.
I feel like yeah. this, Jane did a good, like, a fantastic job in fleshing out these characters who are going through these issues in their lives. And, you know, again, on the casting, I think they mm-hmm. did a great job in portraying these things. And I wouldn't put it beyond them to have written into this story reactions from the point of view, like going super into it and doing reactions from the point of view of someone who was going through, say, with Maddie, like an abusive parent, mm-hmm. the abuse to what extent, I don't know, but like their empathy towards someone that they may have lashed out at someone immediately felt guilt, and empathy towards that person went over to comfort. And from there it goes on.
That actually makes sense. Yeah.
I'm finding myself in a movie like this, just putting myself into the different characters' headspace and how they're reacting, like talking about their friendship, their odd dichotomy with each other, but it all makes sense from where they're coming from. Sorry, I'm rambling now, but I find it so fascinating.
Also, at this point, they're not essentially like abandoned, but they are just two kids with like no attachments at that moment. And I think there's also like a notice of that. She willingly, because she's trying to get away from like her abusive family, and him because his mom's busy doing other stuff, and then soon with other things that pop up. But they're both very lonely, isolated people. And I think they see that in each other immediately.
I feel like they have to see each other immediately, because they're the only two people who would sit on the floor of a cafeteria that has the tables overturned onto the tabletop sitting upright. Could not understand that at all, but I was totally into it. I don't know why.
I was like, that's a choice.
It's really,
like
really
don't
interesting.
Don't know why you do it, but I
way
like
to
it.
Design that set.
It was
forced them to sit by the Fruitopia machine.
Fruitopia. 100% Fruitopia machine.
It was Fruitopia.
I had one of those in my high school, and I immediately went, oh, Fruitopia machine.
Oh, yeah, you could taste it. I still taste it. My roof of my mouth has just got all sticky and sugary. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, it feels so good.
Excellent. One night, 2 years after they first started talking about this show, they are once again watching the show together at Maddie's house, and Maddie experiences unexplained emotional distress while watching the show. Naturally, she's going to decide that she needs to run away, and she wants Owen to join her. So what he's going to do is come clean to his parents about sneaking out because he doesn't want to run away.
I loved that scene. And I've been in the room with somebody who's had such an over-the-top reaction to something that they can't explain what it is. And I remember it was during college, and we were all just hanging out in a dorm room together, just a bunch of people. And we were, for some reason, watching The House of Sand and Fog, which couldn't tell you anything about that movie now.
As and you do.
One of the girls in the room had just this really strong reaction to some sort of death scene. And I think it was like a plastic bag over the head or something. And she reacted hard to it. And it brought me right back when I was watching this, because the way Maddie reacts to watching this show, I just think is fucking beautiful.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Shortly after that night, Owen's mother passes away from cancer. Maddie disappears without a trace, and the Pink Opaque is abruptly canceled after 5 seasons.
Talk about a snowball of hurt for Owen. That is
right, all at once.
That is a recipe for, well, not a lot of hope.
8 years pass. Maddie suddenly reappears in Owen's life, claiming to have spent the time she was missing living within the Pink Opaque as the character Tara. She insists that her current reality, their current reality, is the show's Midnight Realm, and that Mr. Melancholy has successfully trapped them there, and they are slowly suffocating.
I pissed and I shit my pants.
I pissed and I shit my pants.
One of my favorite parts of this whole fucking movie. Man. Just her delivery, all of it.
This is the scene in the bar where we have those musical numbers, and we will talk about them more when we get to music, but I will say I absolutely love the claw machine number with Sloppy Jane and Phoebe Bridgers, but the psychic wound performance took me right out of the movie.
It honestly reminded me of Chasing Amy.
It did have Chasing Amy vibes. Also a Jersey movie.
Also a Jersey movie. I'm owning it this week. This is my time to shine.
Is this the general theme, the running through line of Jersey movies?
Yes, every single one is exactly like this. Yes.
Amazing.
No, come on. No, but it reminded me of Chasing Amy. You have the bar scene, and you have, and I agree with Brian, how that first song, and I don't know the artist or the song, and I'm sorry for that, but it really worked really well. And when she sang I Saw the TV Glow, my first thought was, oh, Brian's going to love that.
I do love a song about the movie.
Did you do the whistle snap?
Hot Tub Time Machine.
Ding. There it is.
Did the thing.
But I'm also right there with you that the second song, you get it in its entirety, and I feel the pain that the singer was going through. But it was one of those, please cut. Please cut. I got it. Please cut. type things. And it's, I don't know. Like, the more I'm thinking about it, it's like, maybe they didn't cut because they want you to live with this a little bit longer to feel uncomfortable about it. And I get that, but I'm still working through stuff.
Yeah. I think you're on the money. You are supposed to linger in it. It's very David Lynch, make you sit in this. And I mean, it does it to make you listen to what they're going through, because I think it's supposed to mirror the confusion and struggle Owen's going through at that exact same time in the bar, because Maddie's back, and what does that mean? So I also think, you know, as much as I like it, it's a little fart sniffy, it's a little pretentious, but I think it's fun.
What is Owen going through?
The confusion.
At what point? At this point specifically?
I don't know, because I know at the beginning we have a start where they're watching the Pink Opaque together. And Owen says something to Maddie, and Maddie's like, you know, I like girls, right? And he's like, yeah, I don't. Fine. That's fine. And it's a great little scene, because she's like, well, do you like girls? He goes, I don't know. And I love that. It was such a genuine conversation that they were having, coming together, understanding each other. But I'm just trying to figure out, like, we understand what Maddie's going through. It's laid out pretty thick what she's going through. But the Owen part was the part I'm having a little trouble understanding. And Go ahead, Ryan.
Okay, so I've been holding my tongue, and I've heard that this movie is a lot of telling and not showing, and we've just been talking about that, and it's just been out there, and I've not been able to rebut it. Owen's perspective is this entire movie, and it is showing his perspective, which is a hiding, a masquerade of, like, keeping everything in check, of repression. This whole movie is repression. He is repressing these moments where he let out his inner self with Maddie. That's what it is. And he's running away. He refuses to accept any of this. But what
is he running away from? I think I'm trying to understand. I got that too.
The scariness of doing something that'll change your life dramatically as like saying, hey, I feel more comfortable in women's clothing than men's clothing. That's what it is. Like, that's why you have the brief snippets of him in the mirror. And she's like looking at him and smiling and kind of getting like almost this flirty smile and look, because she's now into him because she's into her, maybe. And like, that's the whole thing. But that is too scary. And that's why he immediately like pulls the trigger and runs to the neighbor's mom and says like, hey, I've been lying. You have to call this off. Because he puts his foot out into this world, this scary world. And he even says as much, I think. He says, like, I feel like there's a void inside of me, but I'm too afraid to look inside. I don't want to do that. I'm too afraid. And this movie is from the perspective of somebody who's too afraid. So you see just little brief moments and glimpses and hints of things. And so he's running away from all of that because it's just too big of a shift.
There's no going back from that.
Or at least that's his perspective, yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, like you said, everything changes, right? Everything changes, and there's no going back from that. And I honestly, you said it so, so beautifully, dude.
Thank you.
It is that fear that living as your authentic self will make it so that the place you think you belong is no longer right for you.
Which is funny.
Do we ever see where he thinks he belongs?
That's what I was going to say. You can tell that he doesn't feel like he belongs in this world. I think it's just...
Yeah.
What I love about this shit, and what I'm looking so much forward to getting even deeper into this movie, is that we all can see different things into it too, because to me, this movie also obviously harkens to nostalgia and the craving for nostalgia, for what we had as a youth when all you could care about was some silly TV show, and this desire to have that and to take things back to where they made sense for a little bit of time, because shit, we don't know what we're doing. And I think it's, you get that towards the end when he watches it on streaming. I'm so excited to say this or go into this, because I feel like we all have different interpretations of this movie itself. Because I feel also, I don't think Maddie ever came back.
Same. And we'll get there. It's a whole suicide thing that I have been thinking
of. I don't go that with it, but I think after she leaves, she's gone. And Owen is trying to come to terms to things himself and using Maddie as a self insert to talk to himself.
It's interesting.
And
I didn't read it that way.
It's also like she mentions that she got buried alive and she's trying to get him to bury himself alive, which I guess could be pushing his feelings down even further. But I took it as him contemplating just he can't go anymore.
Nah, see, I took that as the rebirth to become his true feminine self that he sees himself as. He would have to kill his male self, which is what he's scared of and doesn't want to commit to. And that's why he's using Maddie, because Maddie is the tough girl that he always was friends with, and she did the things that he couldn't do. And that's why I don't think she comes back, but every time we see her going forward is him using her to try to psych himself up, but he still can never come to it.
But to answer your question, Dave, I think we do see him where he feels like he truly belongs, and that's that very brief 2-year period on Maddie's floor watching the TV where he could just be himself with the one person that he let see him.
I think it's even briefer. I think it's the brief glimpses. even briefer glimpses, but yeah.
When he's pink.
Yeah.
That mm-hmm. part of his life that he's just trying to grasp at, that he's just getting fingertips.
I like it. This was good shit. I had to say it.
At Maddie's urging, Owen rewatches the final episode of the show, a cliffhanger episode where Tara and Isabel are both buried alive. Owen, unsure of what to believe, has a severe mental breakdown, smashes his head through the TV screen, and naturally Fred Durst pulls him out, warning him the dangers of breaking stuff and that he's got to keep on rolling, baby.
Also, different reading of that scene, not an abuse scene.
Nope.
Right.
Nope, I didn't take it as an abuse scene. I took it as a father who's looking out for his son, but doesn't actually know how to connect with that kid at all.
And exactly. That's just the greatest disconnect and not understanding and being so confused. And perfectly done.
He doesn't seem like a bad dad. He seems like a dad who doesn't understand.
He's he doesn't have the tools. That's, he doesn't understand what's happening.
It's 1996 and
it's 2006.
Right.
Oh, in that spot.
Yeah.
Still, it's 2006.
It's 2006. Jersey, Fred whatever. Durst doesn't have the tools to deal with this.
I do love the caked on white face just to make him look that much more.
There's still an eeriness, though, because you recognize him and you're like, wait a minute. Who is it? There's a weird familiarity. Even when you see Pete and Pete, you're like, oh, is that? No. It's almost like they don't want to beat you over the head with it. It's just they want you to have that slight nostalgia moment.
So speaking on showing, not telling, I think that scene is the suicide scene where he did take pills after the end of Pink Opaque. And it ended so abruptly in a way that was just not satisfying. And that's why they pull back at one point and like he vomits out like static. Mm-hmm. Because Fred Durst is trying to get him to introduce
and the Luna juice,
the pills and shit. Yeah.
But also, as somebody with asthma, putting them over a steamy thing is good for that when they're in hysterics like that.
It's fascinating that in multiple different parts of this movie, like the beats are all there. And
I don't know. It all seems really open to interpretation. And we'll get there.
Definitely.
Yeah. We'll get there.
Maddie recounts her experience of paying a dude $50 to bury her alive, as you do, in order to enter the Pink Opaque. She tries to convince Owen to do the same, believing it will reunite them with their true identities as Isabel and Tara. So she leads him to their high school football field, intending to bury him alive. And we see flashes of Owen dressed as Isabel, and all of this stuff is happening, and he decides at the last second to not let her bury him alive because just in case she's actually batshit crazy, he'd rather not get all murdered is the way I read it. But this is definitely very open to interpretation.
That's a turf field. What's her plan here for the burying alive?
It's just like and also, Beetlejuice.
Well, I don't think I've ever seen a Ray Lewis tackle from that close range before. Like she went full Bobby Boucher, just quick tackle, dropped her, and took off running. And man, I love whenever you get those types of shots where you're like pulled back from it, you get the nice wide lens, you get to see somebody do this run across, and it takes them forever. I absolutely love it. I don't know why. It's a shot that's always stuck with me. Anytime I see
it. It's a fun shot, especially when it's Johnny Depp dressed as a pirate doing it.
Very good.
Yeah.
Sand. You could bury someone in there.
It's not
not on a turf field. This isn't like Beetlejuice where you have to dig up the AstroTurf on the model or something like that. That's where he pops out of, you know what I mean? Like that's
nice fucking model.
What it feels like.
Best luck.
But this is the moment where Owen is choosing once and for all how he's going to live his life. This is his last opportunity to either commit to going into the Pink Opaque or continuing down the road he is already living of just this general monotony, this unextraordinary life that he has. And after this incident, he never sees Maddie again. He continues down that life, haunted by her claims and struggling with his own mental health and uncertainty of, was this the right move? And we cut to 10 years later. Fred Durst finally dies, and Owen loses his job at the movie theater. His depression and his asthma are worsening, which is also a kind of clue to, is he actually buried alive in the pink opaque, and his asthma worsening is an allegory for running out of breath in the quote-unquote real world. He decides to watch the pink opaque reruns on a streaming service, finding it nothing like he remembered it. And I'm sure we can all kind of relate to that.
To make that mistake.
Oh, yeah, man, I haven't watched Power Rangers in a long time. Pull up an episode and you're like, oh, is this really what it was this the whole time?
I liked. They had 42 seasons.
Well, then rose colored glasses, mode, boys.
And then Diva Talks. Call it a day.
That's why I don't
Diva Talks. Yeah, exactly. It's not going to stop me from going back and watching Alex Mack again.
Which movie?
Godspeed.
Secret World of Alex
Mack. The Secret World of Alex Mack.
It was so secret.
So secret. It's a GC-161.
Man, I remember the boss lady in that.
Wow.
Is powerful.
Another 10 years pass, and during a child's birthday party at his workplace, Owen suffers a severe mental episode, believing he is dying. He screams out for help, but everyone around him remains completely frozen. In the bathroom, he cuts open his chest, revealing a TV screen playing the pink opaque inside himself. He returns to work and apologizes to everyone for his sudden outburst.
As you do.
Man.
And that's the movie.
Seeing that box cutter come out and go up to his chest... Dude, I was like, oh, here's the horror going on now. But,
Yeah, that's about it.
But it's weird that...
Though, the ice cream man's kind of gross, and so is Mr. Melancholy. Yeah. Like, that's a really weird effect.
Mr. Melancholy is creepy.
Yeah, it's unnerving, I guess.
Super weird.
I'd say those are pretty horror.
I dig it.
Yeah.
Was that not a riff on like that old silent film movie thing with like the moon?
That's a riff on the Trip to the Moon. Smashing Pumpkins.
Trip to the Moon. That's in 1920s.
Well, which is a riff on that.
Yeah. But I'm saying like even the man's name, Mr. Melancholy, is because of Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
A very popular record from the 90s. I hated it.
And they do Tonight Tonight. Snail Mail does a version of Tonight Tonight here.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Story and motivation.
So I described what happened on the screen, but there's obviously a lot of subtext happening.
Oh, there. Yeah.
so much.
Yeah, as he's, you know, opening up his chest and smiling in the mirror and then goes back to work. But there's still like that glimmer of hopefulness. Like, oh, something changed here.
See, and I see the
before
the...
it ends.
The scream of death by himself and everybody ignoring him is just the general ignoring that the trans community feels now. I mean,
well,
they're screaming and they feel
it's unheard. Even worse. It's somebody who probably knows that they are that and has refused to do that. So
that
they're
too.
Stuck
yes.
in this fucking limbo of not having any life because they've not stepped into any world fully. They're just trapped in this indecision. And that is so fucking horrifying. That's more horrifying
awful place
than
to be.
Luna Juice or anything.
It is, but is Maddie the right person to try to help this person then?
Yes, because they are both in that community and they both... She is going
but
through what
kind
he
of
is
just
going
like,
through in a
yeah.
different way, but they are very similar. And from what we've seen, the only two who are even close to having similar, I guess, exposures to that.
And again, I also say yes, because in my interpretation, that's not Maddie at all anyways. It's his own subconscious forming
it
Maddie.
It is.
But then where's he? What basement is he going to? Whose floor is he sleeping on?
No, I mean, Maddie is real. He forms the friendship
okay.
with her.
Well, thank God for that, because I thought this was something entirely
after
different.
After she runs away, when she reappears, she's not really there. That's him going through and using the only person who's cared about him and the self-described tough badass chick that he loves and identifies with so much that is trying to be like, hey man, we got to do this, and he can't like Ryan. It's that life lived in between, a life less lived, It's the realization of a life wasted. You know, mm-hmm. so many people go through that. Like, why didn't I sing it? That's the real horror. I could have been somebody. I could have been a contender. You know,
could have been a contender.
So, except this is just more primordial and just I could have been happy, and that's so mm-hmm. fucking
yeah.
heartbreaking.
I'm not myself. Which, yeah.
But instead, there's years and years and years of loneliness that can do Lord knows what to somebody's mind and cause. Mm-hmm.
There's, yeah.
I don't know, old friends to appear. Like, that was my interpretation as well, Kyle. And I'd be hard pressed to, think of it in a different way because of that's just what I took from that.
Yeah. And I can totally understand the part of loneliness because, I mean, there's been studies done that nostalgia is kind of just a buffer for loneliness mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. a lot of the time. And that was my big takeaway of just like, okay, I understand what they're going for here. But yeah. The part that didn't sit well with me story-wise was it felt like Maddie was telling Owen what to do a lot. Like, you need to come with me. Like, I can free you. I can do this. I could do that. We could do this together. It was kind of felt like she was forcing him a bit too much. That's like she had her own kind of discovery. I
disagree.
I still take it back that I do. Hold on, Ryan. One second.
No, I
feel like she does come back.
So just
yeah, I know he does.
I want to.
Yeah, that's
yeah. Buff you back when you're done. But just so you know,
do you think that she comes back? I don't either.
She comes back.
I think she comes back. Yeah,
but I'm saying that's not her.
But okay, no. But my issue with it is I felt like she was telling him what to do too much. Like she was really, really pushing this already insecure person, and it just, to me, mm-hmm. I don't want to use the word bullying because I don't believe it was that, but no. I do believe that she was trying to push him mm-hmm. out of whatever, I don't want to call it a comfort zone either, because it's not, yeah. it's a discomfort zone.
I think it's sort of desperation.
But I felt like she was almost too pushy.
Yeah, she doesn't want to do it either. She wants somebody to come along.
Yeah, so, I think she's desperate enough to
Yeah, she needed the person with her,
exactly.
for sure.
But she still does it by herself, whereas...
Yeah.
Saw it as a completely different thing.
I love this.
She's
movie.
Telling the truth. I think she's telling the truth that they actually are existing within the Pink Opaque, and she wants to bring him into it. Okay. And that's why she's telling him so much. Like, you have to come with me. We have to do this.
And
that is confirmed when he opens up his chest.
Huh. Okay. Huh. I did not take it that way, but I do want to counter, or not counter Dave, but clarify that I agree that Maddie gets very pushy, especially during the planetarium scene. But that is like her third push. It has been like slow, gradual
That's the
steps
big one.
Until like, hey, it's been this long, dude. Like, I've given you time, I've given you patience, but like, I see you for who you are. I saw, and like, we as the audience see, because the only time Owen smiles in this movie is that reflection in the mirror, the reflection she sees. So she sees his truth, and she's just, I can see getting impatient after however many years of waiting for him to see that too, and just trying to push a little bit.
But it's
right
not
or
that
wrong?
Many years because she goes away.
Well,
like, she only comes back briefly, and that's the whole thing. It's one of those, like, is it her right to be able to do this? God damn it, she might not come back.
She gave him a chance.
Hold on, now I'm chewing on this.
Bridge by getting grounded on purpose. She wanted him to come with her. She told him flat out,
because
this town's
Owen
going
and
to
Maddie
kill me,
aren't
I.
real.
E.
They're
I
actually
might kill myself.
Isabel and Tara.
If I stay here any longer, I'm leaving, you leave with me. And when he mm-hmm. grounded himself, like, that is just, I think that's grounds for her to leave, and that's perfectly understandable from both sides. It is reasonable
Agreed
for
there.
Owen to be scared, and it's reasonable for her to take off and leave. They're both
but is
doing
it
the right
reasonable
things
for her
both
to come
of their
back?
Characters. It's just real sad to see one do one that's hurting themselves much more than the other one.
But is it reasonable for her to come back and still push 10 years later?
Maybe.
Is it reasonable
for Morpheus
not
trying to get Neo out of the Matrix?
Come out. She just happened to cross him awkwardly, and then they caught up because he wanted to know more. To which then she started the whole
line of
questions.
No, she did seek him out.
Did she?
She showed up at the movie theater, and he even asked, like, have you been home yet? Like, your parents
were at the grocery store.
Whatever it was.
She was just in the grocery store with a piece of meat. We don't know what she was doing because she was in the middle of her own story. She wasn't there for Owen.
She sought him out there.
I don't know that they're psychically linked.
They have to defeat Mr. Melancholy.
Yeah, that's a very literal read, and I don't think this movie should, like, 95% of be read literally. Otherwise, that's a way to read it, but I don't know that you're going to get a lot out of it that way.
Yeah, but I don't know that even the director knows how we're supposed to read it.
And that's what I love about this movie.
I think they have a pretty good idea how it should be read.
Yeah, there's a quote that they did in Vanity Fair, mm-hmm. where they said, "Transition leaves you traumatized for the rest of your life. If the movie is giving you a feeling at the end of emancipation and transcendence, that's a lie, and then I start to feel gross as an artist."
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the director and writer telling me how I'm supposed to feel.
It's just saying they don't like happy endings.
No, and I understand that.
And that's not necessarily
But it's not a happy ending, but it's the way that I interpreted it.
You can interpret it in many ways. That's just saying that
was, if the movie's giving you a feeling at the end of emancipation and transcendence, it's a lie. That to me is saying that if you took something out of this movie that's supposed to be of joy, that's supposed to be of man, I'm really struggling with the interpretation of this thing. At the end of the day.
You're not necessarily wrong in the way that you're not supposed to feel good watching Schindler's List. But like that's I think what they're saying is like you're not supposed to feel happy because this is a sad tragedy. And I prefer tragedies, and this is a tragedy. So yeah, you should read it as a tragedy, the themes, the connections, all of this stuff. That's for you to interpret it, and I think that's fine. I don't see what the hang-up is with that.
I'm really, really, really struggling with how to read this movie.
How do you read it? How do you read it at all?
And that's part of the issue, is that I couldn't put myself in the shoes of any of the characters. I couldn't relate to any of the characters. And that makes it really hard to develop empathy while watching it. And it's something that I always look for is whenever I'm even like last week when we talked Double Indemnity, you're able to kind of put yourself into a character of like when you look at someone like a Walter Neff, how to get away with murder at something that you know so well that you're so cocky about. Everyone's had that thought in the back of their head, like, you know what? I bet I could pull this off. Right, not necessarily. With this, you're a better person than I am, Ryan. Congratulations.
I don't think I could do it, and I think I'd get caught, so I know my place, which is never to try. And that's why I resonate with this movie, because it's coming from the place of the downtrodden and never try.
Of the downtrodden, exactly. Yeah, no, and I understand that too. And I don't know, I'm really struggling on how to read this and how to interpret it. And
I mean, again, I think
I feel
at the end of the day, it is the person, it's the life unlived. I mean, that's something I can relate to. I had dreams my entire young life of being this fucking rock star drummer that plays everywhere. And I flirted with it for a bit, but it's obviously not what could have been. And it's a life that I didn't live that I thought I would, that is gone from me and is not going to happen for me at 40. And that level I can relate. I didn't achieve what I thought and what I felt was in my inner core for so long. And like, it's one, like, do you move on? Is that going to crush me? Like, what happens from that? I think you can relate on those levels. It doesn't have to be like, I can't see myself living as a woman, but you definitely didn't achieve the dream that you had as a kid. I wanted to be a veterinarian. I didn't end up with that life. Like, it's still the unrealized, but it's an unrealized on a level that it almost kills you.
Yeah.
Because it's the core of your being, not what you want to do for a job.
I could say, like, I struggle with depression, and there has been times where I will just lose hours of my life frozen in bed, staring, mouth agape, thinking about how I've wasted my entire life. Like, what am I doing? I am an absolute failure. And I can say there's no way. And, like, man, crippling. And I could say, like, there's no way I think it could even touch how Owen probably felt in that moment of realization and just blank and emptiness that you see at the end of the movie. like it couldn't even touch all of that. And I think that, you know, as an all encompassing from the beginning to that point of the movie, I think it does a really good job of telling you the beginning and the end of that missing outness, and tells that story from the perspective and position of someone who I will never know what they're really going through. But I am fortunate enough to, you know, I have a trans employee and a non-binary employee. Like, I am in this world, and I'm glad that I can be a safe place for anybody. And not everybody's in the position that I am. So.
Those are all really interesting points, and I want to start this off. Story motivation, I'm going to go with an 8.
I'm jumping in 10, man. I think this nails everything. The fact that we all discussed it and had different interpretations, it's art. It's perfect. 10.
Yeah. I came in much lower in my head after watching this thing. I was close to like a 3-4 range, but that's why talking about movies is important.
And these boys are really good
at it. What's going on here?
Yeah.
These boys talk about the second high category all the time.
we got to crank some numbers out here, boys. 10.
It goes much faster after story motivation.
I'm glad we brought you up, Dave.
It's not a contest. It's a conversation. I still don't like it. About. Don't get me wrong. I don't like it. I don't like this movie.
But I respect it, damn it.
I'm glad that I got the whole...
I found it...
Go ahead.
I found it very interesting that the entire movie... Owen is not a character that is powerless. Owen makes all of these choices for themselves the entire way through, and then has to suffer the consequences of the decision. And by all means, with the information that Owen has at the time, a lot of these feel like the right choice to make. And that's kind of what's scary about it, is that you can make the quote-unquote right choices and still end up with this what-if life of, if I had done this differently, where would I be?
It's a little trail of Reese's Pieces to self-sabotage.
Yeah. It's, you know, with the information he had, he made the choice to not, you know, bury himself alive, which was probably smart.
Yeah.
It's on a turf field.
At the same time.
It was on a turf field. That's...
You can't bury there.
Who was going to bury her after he buried him? That's what I want to know.
God.
For me, it's a 9.
I'm glad that I got the little bitch about feeling like I was sold a bill of goods at the beginning of the movie with like the horror and stuff, because with that aside, and the fact that they'll always still go hand in hand with my viewing of this movie, I think the story and motivation in this was fantastic, and I will give it a 9.
I think that leaves me. So I'm with Kyle. This is art. Art is a mirror. It inspires a lot of conversations. This is a 10. I won't go higher. But I will just also add in again, I fucking really love when movies do this, that the narrative is a reflection of a character or a theme or their perspective or something. And the way that this whole movie is laid out is Owen's perspective, which is so fucking cool and just like a neat way to kind of frame it all. Then you throw in the 90s stuff. That's great. This is a 10.
That is going to give an average of 9 for story motivation, and we're going to move right into Owen and his choices and his perspective for protagonist.
Man, much like last week, I don't know how to approach this.
We don't know a lot about Owen.
Yeah.
But it's by design.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I mean about not knowing how to approach this. It's not the whole, like, oh, who's the good guy here, you know? It's like...
Well, let's figure out, who's the bad guy then? Who's the antagonist?
Well, the antagonist, yeah, is Mr. Melancholy.
Society.
The little puppy.
Owen. Owen's inability to accept his truth.
The truth. The truth is the real...
It's weird what happens when you squish art into a format.
Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't had a movie that's just made me think this much in a long time. and just like talking about it and trying to figure out what angle to approach or attack it from.
This one's a hard one. I'm struggling with the protagonist and antagonist. We can tackle both at the same time because it feels like they are very tightly intertwined.
I'll go ahead and start with protagonist then. I'll say it's a 7. It's good. It's not great. They are a function of the plot. And I say they because I would consider Owen and Maddie both protagonists, as Tara and what's the other one's name? Isabel are also like the Pink Opeya. So like they're both the protagonists and you're getting kind of both of their, it's just filtered through Owen's perspective. But like Dave pointed out, by design, you're not supposed to know all that much about them, just kind of their motivations. And for that,
he says he's a boy who likes TV.
Yeah, they're good. They're not the best. And I can be honest with that and say they're 7s.
Hmm.
I'm on board with that. I also will give a 7.
Could we say that Owen is both the protagonist and antagonist here?
You could.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Because Mr. Melancholy is absolutely just Owen's sadness and self-sabotage, who's trying to stuff himself into a smaller box inside themselves. So.
Mm-hmm.
Or alternatively, an actual supervillain that lives in the sky.
In
an alternate dimension and has trapped Owen, aka Isabel, within the Midnight Realm.
Okay, Ryan, you said there's not a lot to get out of this movie looking at it literally. I disagree. That sounds fantastic.
Okay. Right? All
right. It's very Matrix-esque if you look at it that way.
To help my brain and the time flow here, I'm going with a 7 as well.
I don't remember what interview I read, but the Matrix has come up multiple times in interviews.
As it should.
Well, the identity, yeah.
Well,
I guess.
I mean.
Uh-huh. That makes
an
sense.
An allegory.
Yeah.
Matrix, just an elongated allegory of the cave when you think about it.
I feel higher on this. Just because I feel Owen kind of really nailed on this autism level, the confusion level. I don't know. I go 8.
I think I'm kind of in the ballpark with you guys. I think I'm going to go 6, though. I liked something that Kyle said about how he does the right thing. And he keeps doing the right thing. And it turns out that he still has to live with the consequences of doing the right thing. And that's the stuff that he has to kind of eventually stuff farther and farther down. But I had a lot of trouble connecting with the protagonist. I had a lot of trouble with it. So that's kind of my hang up there. And I've read that you get different things out of it with multiple viewings. And I'm sorry, this is going to be my only viewing of this thing. I don't have any real plan that's on fair. Going back to it. But I wish I was able to relate a little bit more. I wish I was able to relate a little bit more. Because I'm actually like psyched about how much you guys are getting out of this, and this is really enjoyable listening to what you got out of this. I'm loving it.
I'll tell you right now, I told these guys on the Patreon episode, which you listeners can find on Friday in your podcast app if you subscribe for at least $1. Anyways, I was telling these guys earlier that this is one of the first movies that I didn't even rewatch for the show because I didn't want to. It's like I have my interpretation and feeling on this movie, and I didn't really want that to change because I liked what I got out of it.
I liked it both times. I don't care. I want Ryan to watch it one more time, thinking about my point of view.
How cool would it be if Ryan watched it with Kyle's point of view and he goes, "This movie fucking sucks, guys."
Son of a bitch, you're right. Fuck. Or watch it with the literal.
It is just a fucking
really
moon man. God damn it.
Brian was right. It's fucking Power Rangers.
That's not bad, though.
Psychic Link was actually talking about between Owen and Isabel, not between Isabel and Tara.
Can't bury somebody in turf. God, I feel like
this movie that's a whole homage to the 90s teen supernatural drama isn't actually being its own supernatural drama?
No.
Ooh. Anyway, it's a 7 for protagonist total, and now we move on to antagonist.
I'm going to just jump off the rip. I think Owen's a better antagonist than a protagonist. I'm giving this a 9 because we're all our own worst enemy.
Like Lit says. And he does kick the living shit out of himself.
All right. So if I'm going off my interpretation of the antagonist being his dickhead boss named Dave, I say perfect 10 out of 10.
As Daves are.
No.
His name is Dave, isn't it?
Really, though, I liked a lot of the antagonists. If you count Owen as an antagonist himself, sure. I thought Marco and Polo were just fucking weird enough.
Yeah.
And the odd interpretive dancing worked. I thought Mr. Melancholy, when he actually showed up, I was like, all right, this is obviously not a 90s TV special effect. This is something on a completely different level because it worked very well. I always get freaked out from that Aphex Twin camera style view. So I say 8.
I'm right up there with you guys in the 9-8 area. I think no matter how you look at this, whether it is Owen as getting in his own way, or if it's a literal interpretation with Mr. Melancholy pulling the strings, which I'm still leaning toward personally, but it's you feel it. It's visceral, and you know that despite the opportunity for things to go a different way, it kind of has to go this way, and that is unavoidable and horrifying. I'm going to go with an 8.
Nice.
I'm going to go with an 8 also, mostly because I think melancholy is the most frightening fucking thing in the world. This looking back state of reflection that I'd never, ever want to do. So I can get that one entirely. Yeah, I'll go with an 8.
I really loved what everybody said. But I'm just more positive on it. I think it's a 10. I think the antagonist is perfect for this movie. I think Mr. Melancholy explodes out to just, like I said, a general sweeping like regret of not living your full life. And it is, I think that is like death as a constant is like, that's a 10, right? And this is like pretty close to that. So that, I agree with the Owen stuff. I think the designs are fucking sick and creepy. I love it. It's 10. These 10. Whoever the antagonist is, 10.
I just put it together. Does Fred Durst wear white face paint to resemble the moon because he's Mr. Melancholy in real life?
In real life? IRL?
Could be.
Well, and
it could be Owen, that Owen sees his dad wanting to repress him, even though his dad doesn't really care at all. It's just when you have that, you might think that, and you read into things a bit. So, yeah.
There's also an interesting bit where Maddie says that when her friendship with Amanda gets messed up, she says that she feels like she was a spy sent here. And then you see that Amanda is played by the same actress who plays Mr. Melancholy and Marco, and also one of the clown villain that's in the show, and it kind of lends a little bit of maybe she is a spy sent here for by Mr. Melancholy. I'm gonna keep pushing my narrative
red
one way or another. We did average a 9 on antagonists, and now we're gonna talk about director.
Woo! I'll go again. I don't know, it's crazy because I do go high on this, but I like looking at it from the themes, the art. I think it's when I saw Midsommar, I was really impressed with how they captured the feeling of being on hallucinogens. And I can't speak to that. I feel pretentious saying it, but like,
poser.
I feel the autism viewpoint from this movie is very accurate, like the way it's presented. And I don't know. It does a lot of things. I'm a doc. Again, I get why they're there. I just the double music performance is a little amp for me, so I'm gonna take it down and give it a 9.
I don't, as much as I didn't enjoy the double music, I really can't knock Doc points for that. The feelings that I got while watching, and like, they did a fantastic job on being able to convey that through a screen and make me feel those things, like You know when you feel it in your stomach when you're watching somebody go through something, because you can kind of relate, everybody here but Dave, you can relate to what's going on, and it's, I'm going a 10 on this one. I thought they were able to really convey this story, whatever your interpretation is of it, like fantastically. So
I'm in the same boat. I really like what they did here, and the themes and the vision behind this whole thing. And we are working with a director and writer here, which we will get more into screenplay later, but this is definitely a singular vision from a singular artist. Mm-hmm. And damn it, it's good. So I'm with Kyle, though. I am going to dock a point for the double music performance, too. So it is a 9 for me.
I'm going to go with a 6. And it's because I felt like there was a lot of telling and not showing, which is insane because I'm actually reading through the screenplay as we're talking about this. And it should be all showing and not telling for the like the lack of dialogue that I'm seeing here. But the movie feels unbalanced to me because the first 45 minutes, first half of this movie, I was really, really into it. It was setting up these two characters, the relationship they had. And then once we hit the double music again, I got pulled right out. And the movie just felt entirely different going forward from there. Like, it was almost unbalanced. And the planetarium scene was the one that really did it for me. I was just like, I'm good now with this movie. Like, I can have it wrap up. I feel like she's just talking at me at this point, and I didn't care for it. And maybe that's the part where I felt like, oh, and maybe he didn't want to be talked at, and that's why he ended up the way he did. But Maddie really, or Tara, whatever the fuck she was at that point, really rubbed me the wrong way. I do want to give it an extra point bump because you don't get to use the word auteur very often anymore, and very much can use it here. So I'm going to go with the 7 then.
Planetarium scene was my favorite. Just emphasize the
dichotomy. So fucking let's further that dichotomy. I'm actually not with Dave on a lot of this, but I'm right there with Dave in the planetarium scene. That is the one, especially the second time around. I think this is where you can see, like, this is still a director kind of getting their feet. That scene goes on for way too long. It is an exposition dump. And as much as you want to color it up with fancy visuals, the movie grinds to a halt for 10 minutes to, like, give you the cipher, which is needed for people who aren't catching up to it. But I think the smart people have caught up to it already by that point. So it's just like, it's a bit much in that scene. So I'm right there with Dave. That said, auteur 100%. I love the use of colors and all. Well, no, that's a different one. I love how Jane Schoenburn is really able to just, like, kind of tie together, as I said, a movie around the perspective of Owen. I think those clunky moments, I love the double music scene. I think it's more of, like, and I hate to say it, but as the millennials say, it's a vibe. And I think that's the intention.
I want to lower it to a 3.
You might, but, like, I do feel like, you're right. The first 40 minutes, the sky's still open. There's a lot of possibilities. And then we learn things as Owen learns things, and the movie clunks and shifts, and it gets more and more awkward and depressing as it goes. And I think that's the intention. And I do think if you're just as, like, an experience, I don't think the last 30, 40 minutes are nearly as fun as, like, what comes before, if you can even consider it fun. But
I didn't think it was fun. And I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's just I felt like maybe it was because, again, I went into this completely blind, not knowing anything about it. And it was actually kind of fun to do. And it was actually, I watch a lot of movies in my headset, and it's mostly so I don't pick up my phone. I can actually just sit there and pay attention because the movie's just being blasted into my eyeballs. The first 45 minutes of this movie, I was so, so, so into. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe it went against the expectation of where I thought it was going to go, not knowing what this was at all.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
That it might have, like, affected it quite a bit, and it feels like it did. But
yeah, I get that.
I think the literal interpretation is most in line with what I was expecting and why I like that narrative the best.
And it's,
so I can see that.
It's a fun narrative. I think it's a good thing to jump off of. And I love movies that just have layers to them. And I agree with what you read, that this is, I think, something that will reveal itself with rewatches, as, like, I do think some of the clunky parts will reveal themselves too, but, like, it's still absolutely worth watching, and the direction's really great. I'm going to give it a 9.
All right. That is an average of 9 for director, and we move into style and tone.
I'll be first, and I'll be quick. Give that bitch a 10.
I am right there with you.
I'm giving
10. The colors, that it's amazing.
I'm giving this, I don't know how often I'm going to do this, but I'm giving this my first 11. This did literally everything that it could early on in the movie. It couldn't have done anything more to make me feel like I was watching something ripped straight out of my 90s childhood.
Yes.
Every little bit about that, down to when they're watching the Pink Opaque, they literally shot it on, they converted it to a VHS, then to a Betamax, just to like get it looking like it was shot and put onto a TV in the 90s. And then like it just carries through to the end of the movie. Like it just changes as the movie goes on in all of it, just amazing ways.
I'm going to go with an 8 with a 1-point bump for New Jersey. I feel like I'm allowed to do that.
Jersey.
But then also a 1-point reduction for the planetarium.
You just want to make me keep typing stuff, don't you?
But then I also want to give it a 2-point. No.
redacted.
And take away 6 because.
Dude, just the seeing Mr. Sprinkly as like the original Vision and then the nostalgia version, just
that's fun.
That alone is a 10. I fucking love it.
Yep, I'm right there with all of y'all. This is a 10. No bump needed. Just perfect. I loved all of this style.
Great. There's an interesting thing that colors. Owen said with the Mr. Sprinkles, the ice cream thing, how he said he felt embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
That stuck with me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That bit stuck with me. It goes back to even last week when I told you guys, like, sharing older movies that I absolutely love is such a big vulnerability of mine. So it was almost like, if you guys don't like this, I'm going to be pretty fucking embarrassed. Like, I understand the feeling.
They use sprinkles, baby.
That's going to average out to a 10 for style and tone. Next category is screenplay.
I'm going to go first on this because I read it.
Okay.
The planet. There's a lot of, I guess, direction within the screenplay. It tells a lot of what's going on. There's not a lot of dialogue. And then you get 5 pages of Maddie talking. And she is Maddie in the screenplay at the end of In the Planetarium. But it's 5 fucking pages of talking.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Next time you come sucking off Kevin Smith, I'll bring this up.
Kevin Smith, first of all, would adore you bringing up sucking off anything.
Oh, I know.
69-point bump.
That's pretty good.
37-point bump. Try not to bump any more points on your way through the parking lot.
That's good. That's good.
The screenplay overall, it's really well written. I'm a really big fan of the way it's done. It does tell a lot, which is weird. Still, like, it's just, I don't know, like, what we see on the screen, I don't know why I have this feeling of it told me so much and didn't show me so much, despite there being such a large lack of dialogue in the screenplay. I don't know why I can't shake this feeling, though.
I think, did you give a score?
No, and I'm still debating it. It's, I find it absolutely fascinating.
I think the lack of dialogue plays
Jane
to
Schoenbrunner was able to pull off
the script's strengths, like, because
yeah, but you take such an abstract idea of what it is to look inside and really try to figure out identity and figure out who you are, that even just translating that to paper is really, really difficult, and I really, really love that. But I cannot get over the 5 pages at the end. I cannot do it. I'm gonna go with a 7.
Yeah, I'll give it the Maddie monologue bump to an 8, which is what I just flashed anyways.
I think the lack of dialogue plays this movie's strengths, because you don't need a lot of it. And maybe I can catch some flack on this because I haven't seen it in like 2 months, but the planetarium scene is not something that I even remember from that movie. It's everything.
It's like it's the thing that's sticking with me, man.
Well, because it's so fresh, and I shit but it's my something pants. That doesn't stick with you. Well, maybe it will for you because it's really bothering.
I don't know. I don't know, because this is one of those movies I'm probably going to still think about, which is a good thing for this movie, which is, I like that, knowing that it's, but it could also go the other way of, the second we're done recording this, I go, what do we talk about?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how I'm going to react to this movie still.
It's been brought up a couple of times, but like Midsommar, when that movie ended, I was like, I don't know if I like that or not. But then I thought about it for 3 days and I realized I haven't stopped thinking about this movie. I woke up the next day and went on YouTube.
Jumped
and
off a cliff.
Up, like, people talking about it and their theories and stuff. I'm giving the script an 8 just because sometimes less is more. And I don't even remember the part that you guys disliked. So
you threw it so deep in your subconscious that you buried that in the turf.
It's very possible. It's very possible.
The planetarium is buried in the turf.
I think that just means the rest of it is so memorable that I forgot the bad part.
The thing I like about the planetarium is they set it up so early in the movie because they talk about the special days at school and when it is, you know, when it changes and it's no longer school and that's what makes it special. So like they're really hammering home this particular thing, and then the planetarium set up and it's exactly, yeah, it does go on too long for sure. I love these movies where you get somebody who is living in their world and they're discovering things about the world they live in as they go. It's a common theme with things like The Matrix, The Truman Show, this movie. You see it a lot in superhero movies where the rules of their universe start to change as they become more aware of what it actually is. And I dig that so much. And I think this is going to be an 8 for me.
Well, I think I'm right there with Kyle on the higher end of this one, because I think the screenplay, I'll just dock off the point for the Maddie exposition, because that's just what it is. I'm not going to hammer that home anymore. I will say I think a lot of the dialogue is really smart and insightful, and it is concise. There's not a lot of words. It is very to the point, and every little line hits like a fucking hammer. So I think there's a lot of weight and worth to that. Like Dave brought up, I love the line, like, do you like girls? I don't know. Boys? I think I like TV shows. And, like, little things like that, like, that will just
you reminded me of being there.
There's a lot of those things. Or I'm not going to get into all of them, but I think the script is, like, really smartly written. I think the dialogue's so sharp, and that's part of the screenplay, and it's all, like, just about perfect. Like I said, some clunk with the pacing, that is it. 9.
All right. That averages out to a perfect 8 for screenplay. Next category is music. Score was done by Alex G. We have a lot of '90s music peppered in here, but covers by bands who are very involved in the LGBTQ community.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
I'm not going to say much more, because pretty much I feel all my scores are going to mirror Ryan. So I'll just give my scores and let him expound. I'll go 10.
Wow.
All right.
Also, Sloppy Jane, the lead singer, she likes to be naked and perform. And she's got a CLB. So
it's CLB.
Cute little butt.
Of course. What else could it be, Ryan?
I honestly did not know.
It ended in B. It's going to be butt. Just got to work out the other two.
Sloppy Jane, been huge in the punk scene forever. Like you said, all these bands. punk and transgenderism are very hand in hand, especially in the late. And I love punk music, yeah. And I love my trans homies, and I love all that hand in hand too. So I'm very familiar with all the music in this movie. So again, shutting up, 10.
I don't know if not having seen it is like good or bad for me, but I actually enjoy it because it's my experience grind of watching this, and I can look back on my experience and how I felt on it, because I don't remember any specific thing that popped out, but I remember there being a song part that really kind of annoyed me, and I don't remember exactly what it was, but there was a part that I just didn't like, and for that I will give it a 7, because otherwise I don't really remember much of it.
I'm right there with Sean, and I'm going to probably accidentally speak for Sean here, but I feel like the part that he's talking about is the bar with the double song that really pulls you out of, changes the mood, kind of the movie. It feels like it's like a separator almost. But the music's super appropriate. It fits the time period. It fits the movie really, really well. I'm going to go with a 7.
I am right there with you guys. I think the music's super appropriate. I love that they used bands that are important to the movement. I like they used music from the era with covers. But that psychic wound by King Woman scene took me out of the movie so bad that it has to be a 7 for me too.
So, no surprise, this is my shit, this is my jam. You'll go back to listen to the music episode, I am a sad girl boy, through and through, and this is sad girl, sad thems, through and through, and I fucking loved all of it. As soon as I heard Caroline Palachek, I don't know how to pronounce their name, I am so sorry, I was in.
The entire college family.
Call him. Seeing Phoebe Bridger, seeing King Woman, I loved it. I loved all of it. I loved the soundtrack. I loved the actual score that's really haunting and ethereal. It's fucking perfect, mm-hmm. too. This is an 11 all around. I love this. I've listened to the soundtrack multiple times since this movie's been out. This is my jam.
All right. That averages out to an 8 for music. The next category is box office, and for this one, we're at one score. It is not open to discussion. This movie cost $10 million to make, and it only grossed $5.4 million. Yes.
Yep.
I didn't know that. If you would have told me this is a $4 million movie, I would have said, looks really good for a $4 million movie.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, $10 million movie.
Oh, dear. Okay.
Just barely made back half of that, so that is a 1 on our scale for the box office.
I didn't think that it I had no thoughts that this did any sort of great box office business, but I did not know it was that bad.
I could have told you.
Well, it opening weekend it opened in 4 theaters, which is mm-hmm. a problem.
Usually it Sundance. It did
Sundance. It did all that, and then it opened in 4 theaters in New York and L.A.
That was it.
And it opened to $119,000, which means it was the number one movie in dollars per theater for the weekend. Mm-hmm. But it obviously did not fare well in the box office overall. Didn't so it is a 1 for release. Box office.
This scale is also racist the type against of indie movie movies. That
you could do it with.
It did end up growing in its third week to its peak, where it was, I think, 12th in the box office standings. So.
A grower, not a shower.
If you want to watch a big budget, trans positive nostalgia trip, just watch Ready Player One.
Wow.
That's not wrong.
Well, when you put it that way.
Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong.
Final category is impact on the industry.
Another one.
I think it's a little too new to
yeah.
to really fairly gauge. Can't do I'm going to go 5 like, down the middle just because there's not a whole lot to go off of right now.
Honestly, yeah. I mean, if we're being honest, it's even less. And that's box office and impact will hurt fucking these type of movies any day. But like this is probably a 1 or a 0. It's not going to have an impact on the industry.
Mm. I was going to say 0, to be honest.
Hollywood,
because I don't think
ignore
it's
going to
impact. It might inspire somebody somewhere down the line, but they'll just make more indie schlock that I love, but nobody else does.
Yep.
So
it's really unfortunate the last two categories like are so low because it does not match how I feel about this movie.
Yeah, I knew seeing those categories, I'm like, this movie's fucked. There's nothing it can do.
The scale works, man.
It's got nines all across the board except for the last
scale is scientifically proven, developed over years of being arbitrary.
Yep.
So Dave said 5. Kyle said 0. Sean, where are you?
Zero.
Okay. You think it has no impact on the industry whatsoever?
Yeah, that's true. I was going to give it 1 because it might inspire other artists, but we're talking industry impact, so 0. It's not going to affect the industry. In fact, it might adversely affect the industry, and they might never make these movies again.
But I think that you can look at it a little differently, too, because now knowing this is a $10 million movie that did go into theaters, didn't make its money back, it wasn't ever going to make its money back. You don't put something in that few theaters thinking, we're going to absolutely crush it. Mm-hmm. This is one of those movies for $10 million you absolutely could put into streaming instead of like the $100 million Brightburn or something like that, that you're like, you're terrified of. So you bury it on streaming. That's not what this is.
Yeah.
I wish there was numbers on streaming views because I would be very curious to know how many views this is picked up on Max. Because
it's hard to say.
Yeah, because it was on so many best of lists of last year.
Yeah, and that is the reason that I'm actually going to give it like a 3, is because it is listed in all of these best of lists for the year, and actually, and for being out of genre for the most part for those lists and still ranked so highly, I'm going to give it a 3, which is going to give it just barely a 2 on average for the category. Which is going to give it a 71 total.
Wow.
Hey, folks, womp, womp. I got some news for you and why the scale works. Because on Rotten Tomatoes, the critics gave this thing an 84%. That's out of 226 reviews. The audience gave it a 71%.
Hey.
That's crazy. I feel more like an 84er here, but.
I agree.
It's scientifically proven, though.
Is another sham system.
Scale works.
Not them. This system that these.
I read through a lot of the 226 reviews that were there.
I do too.
I don't understand. It's just, I mean, what has Rotten Tomatoes ever done to you?
It has inspired mediocrity by encouraging a 4-quadrant.
Chase the bottom line.
To get a 100%, you just have to have a 3.5 on average. You just have to be slightly better. But you have to have everybody thinking you're just a little bit better than average to get a 100%. And then that tricks everybody into thinking that movie is like really fucking good, even though it's just the fucking Mario movie. That's just, it's good. But look at Rotten Tomatoes.
Just watch what you want to watch. Why does it matter what the score is? Just watch what you want to watch. If something interests you, go watch it. I can't stand people, and I'm going to about to get on a fucking soapbox here. I can't stand when people ask, is that good? I can't stand
it. Well, it's subjective, but I have had people come to me and use Rotten Tomatoes as a metric of qualifying their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And those people can fuck off a cliff because that is worthless. That is like saying,
Ryan, I've never wanted to I want to hug you because we both just said like the same thing in different ways. I love you, buddy.
Yeah, that's where I'm coming from with my hate on Rotten Tomatoes is I have used it or I've had it come at me so often. It's like, this means the movie is good. I'm like, no. No, it doesn't. It just means you agree with everybody else that it entertained you for an hour.
Maybe it's
because
you have this reaction and they love trolling you.
That could be it, too. That could very well be it.
I love this movie. Guess what its Rotten Tomatoes was, Ryan?
Like how immediately
Ryan's like...
Whereas
I'm just dismissive as hell about it. Like, all right.
Figured something out. All right.
I wish I could have that reaction.
Man. Boys, who's up next week?
It is me. And I knew this week was going to be a doozy. And after last week's very serious episode, I wanted to have some fun. So here's my visual aid. We're going to be talking about this little beauty. We're going to be talking about Paul Rudd and Jason Segel's I Love You, Man. Because this is, I think, a perfect buddy comedy that just makes me fucking happy through and through.
I don't...
Wow. I'm having one of those... I live in a simulation moment right now. because I was literally thinking about this movie like 2 days ago. And I was like, I haven't seen that in a while.
I've been dying to watch this movie for weeks.
Wow. All right. Wow. Nice.
Looking for an excuse to convince my girlfriend to watch it with me. And now I have one, and I thank you for that.
I didn't know this was going
to
hit.
You guys want to set up some contention for next week?
Do we have to?
Uh-oh.
We're going on some good vibes here.
Because I remember feeling it was very bad.
That sounds right. Oh.
What did Rotten Tomatoes say about it?
We'll find out next week. But if you miss hearing our beautiful voices and you want to hear a little bit more, head on over to patreon.com/experiencegrind. And for as little as a dollar, get a bonus episode every week. Sometimes you'll hear us referring to it. We call it a time jump. And if you want to be on the know and know what we're talking about, sign up. You can also join our Discord or social media. All of that stuff is going to be in the show notes right underneath. Brian, man, I'm so hyped that you brought this movie to the table. It's really nice to watch a movie like this and be able to talk about it with other people. So just want to give you a thanks.
I had a good time talking about this one. I love a movie that is that open to interpretation and we can have this kind of conversation. Gets me jazzed.
Mm.
So thank you, boys.
Thank you.
Well,
take us out, Brian.
We're going to see you guys next week for I Love You, Man. And until then, listeners, you can go panko-pake yourself.